each year. All thanks to you and the Power Hour. In the Power Hour, we'll raise a full day's worth of pledges in 1 hour. That way, we can cut down on the length of the pledge drive. So tune into the Power, 7 a.m. Thursday, October 11th, and keep pledge drives as small as possible.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, whose concert of the Newsen is at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, September 28th at University Place Christian Church in Champaign. The program features Mahler's Fourth Symphony for Chamber Ensemble, a Mozart Wind Serenade, some musical surprise at halftime. More information is available at 355-9077 or prairieensemble.org.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. During World War II, the British and the Americans adopted a policy that they called area bombing. It was known by many names. It's all been called pit bombing, saturation bombing, obliteration bombing, and bombing. This was a very controversial tactic in which the two countries deliberately targeted civilian populations in Germany and in Japan in an effort to break those countries' will to fight. Something like 800,000 people died as a result. The question that we'll consider in this part of Focus 580 is, was this a war crime? And that is the basic question of a book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title is Among the Dead Cities, The History and Moral Legacy of the World War II Bombing of Civilians in Germany and Japan. It's recently published by Walker and Company, and the author is our guest, Anthony Grayling. He's professor of philosophy at York College of University of London. And indeed, the book attempts to take a look at this tactic, talk a little bit about how it was conceived, how it was carried out, the impact on the civilian populations of cities in Germany and Japan, and then to ask two large questions. One, was this strategy effective? And two, was it moral? Professor Grayling is spending some time in the United States now to talk about the book, and this morning he is in San Francisco. He's joining us by telephone. Professor Grayling, hello.
Hello there.
Thank you for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure.
Perhaps first, I might begin by talking a little bit about how it was this tactic was conceived. Whose idea was this?
That the idea really had emerged out of before the Second World War about the bombing weapon. For some decades before the Second World War started, there had been great anxiety, actually, in civilian governments about area bombing, about the bombing of civilians, because people thought, based on the experience, which was quite a limited one, really, of what happened in the First World War, that if great bomber fleets with tremendous tonnages of bombs were unleashed on the cities of Europe, the result would be the devastation of civilization. So civilian governments were very anxious about it, and in fact, for years before the Second World War, had tried to come to some kind of international agreement to outlaw it. But the militaries of the different countries realized that it was a weapon that enemy countries might develop, and so they thought they'd better have them themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the run-up to the first of these attacks, was there what sort of debate within government and perhaps between people in the military and government was there? I mean, was there a lot of wrestling with the idea of whether or not this should be done?
Yes, a tremendous amount of wrestling. And in fact, during the 1920s and 1930s, there were a number of international conventions and meetings. For example, in Geneva in the early 1930s, a disarmament conference tried to ban bombing. In fact, so anxious were people about the prospect of it that there was one suggestion that aeroplanes ought to be banned on the grounds that if there was one, then somebody would be sure to throw a bomb at it. But of course, that idea wasn't accepted, and by the mid-1930s, when war seemed to be inevitable, all the major powers had begun to put down plans for building large bomber fleets. And so when the war broke out, all the potential combatants were ready with bombers and bombs. But President Roosevelt of the United States had asked both the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, and Adolf Hitler in Germany to give an undertaking that neither party would use bombing of civilians as a tactic in the war, and they both agreed. And in fact, the deliberate targeting of civilian populations by the Royal Air Force, by the British Royal Air Force, didn't happen in the first 3 years of the war. It only began to happen in 1942.
Mm-hmm. The one, I suppose, could argue that targets like Berlin or Tokyo would be legitimate targets because they were the seats of government. However, some of the other places that were targeted, Dresden, for example, was very controversial because people argued that it had no military significance. How was it that the targets were chosen?
Well, very early in the war, of course, the restraint, relatively speaking, shown by the combatants on both sides of the war involved trying to pick out targets that were genuinely relevant to the war effort of that country. So, for example, industries, military depots, transport links. And in the blitz on London and other British cities in 1941 that the Germans carried out, the aim there was to try to paralyze the British war effort by bombing the docks and the financial district and the administrative district of London. Of course, in practice, that meant something very like an area bombing campaign because bombing was so inaccurate. But the intention was not to bomb the city of London indiscriminately, but to try to get at those targets that would have a real impact on the war effort. And that would apply to sections of Berlin or sections of Tokyo. But you see, the way that the bombing campaigns were actually carried out was on purpose indiscriminate, and the primary target was the civilian population. This was made clear in a directive to Royal Air Force Bomber Command in 1942, in February of 1942, which said the primary target of the Bomber Command's efforts must be the morale of the civilian population.
Perhaps we should talk a little bit about how exactly this was done, because as you say, this involved large numbers of airplanes and lots of bombs, and it wasn't simply a matter of dropping bombs that were explosives to blow up whatever would be underneath, but part of this was also a deliberate effort to start a very large fire, one that very quickly would get out of control so that the level of devastation would be complete.
That's correct, yes. The bomb loads that Royal Air Force Bomber Command used were made up as follows. There were 25% high explosives, the purpose of which was to blow out windows and doors and blow off roofs so that fires could spread. And then the rest, the 75%, was made up of a variety of incendiary weapons, an early form of napalm, petroleum jelly, phosphorus, which has been very controversial in Iraq recently, bituminous substances and oil-soaked rags, anything that would stick and burn ferociously. So, for example, when phosphorus, which would splash over a very wide area, got onto a human being, that person would begin to burn like a torch. And in Hamburg, in the first of the really great firebombing raids in 1943, thousands of people, having been splashed by phosphorus, which was burning, threw themselves into canals to try to put out the flames, only to find to their horror that when they got out of the water, the phosphorus would spontaneously reignite. And it was said and been reported by people who studied the effects of the firebombing, both on Hamburg and Dresden and elsewhere, that adults burned by these means, their bodies would shrink to the size of dolls or babies. And tens of thousands of people died in the air raid shelters and the cellars of the city because the oxygen was sucked right out of the air and they asphyxiated to death. In Hamburg in 1943, in one night, something approaching 45,000 people were killed. In Dresden, the figures are very controversial. Some put it as low as 25,000. Others say as many as 100,000 or more, but there were so many refugees in the city that they could never do a proper count. And in Tokyo, the great firebombing raid on Tokyo in March 1945, they say about 85,000 people killed in a single night. These are tremendous figures.
I think that initially, once the plans were made to do this, I think there might have been some uncertainty about whether, in fact, it would work. If you just set aside the moral issues and looked at the technical issues, whether, in fact, what the intent was, whether that could be accomplished. And certainly it worked, and it worked extraordinarily well if your idea was to destroy as much property as possible and kill as many people. After the first one of these, or the first couple of these, when the Allies could get an assessment of how this had worked and how completely it had worked, at that point, were there people in government who said, This is too much. We can't do. We've done this now, but we can't do this again.
Well, there was certainly a very vigorous campaign in Britain, particularly during the course of the war, by civilian opposition groups who were very concerned about the nature of the bombing and the effect that it was having. I mean, of course, they were, like the rest of the population, keen to see Nazi Germany defeated. And I mean, David, it's very important just to register at this point that everybody realized that the Axis powers in general, and Nazism in particular, really had to be defeated. It was an evil, very formidable, very dangerous, and wicked regime. And everybody was keen to see it defeated, but the big question that people raised when they discussed the techniques being used to defeat it was Royal put by a man called Bishop Bell in the House of Lords in 1943, who said, "We are fighting barbarians here, but why are we acting like barbarians ourselves?" And that was the pressing issue for them. Hmm. And so, yes, in fact, of course, the techniques used by the Allies in their bombing had been very well researched. For one thing, London had been subjected to incendiary attacks, and so people knew, you know, how incendiary bombs worked and what sort of consequences they could have. The Royal Air Force practiced its firebombing techniques on the wooden cities of Lübeck and others in the Hanseatic League on the Baltic before it launched its major attacks on the big German cities. And when the United States Army Air Force began its bombing campaign against Japan in late 1944, prior to doing so, it built wooden Japanese houses in Utah on the Dugway Proving Grounds near Salt Lake City, and it tried different incendiary bombs to see which ones were most effective. So this was very carefully thought out, and the plans were very explicit. And the military and government minds, of course, were looking for a war-winning weapon. And it was in the civilian population that a lot of opposition to it arose.
So as you mentioned, just here to come to a point where we'll pause, I have a caller here. I'll reintroduce the guest. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that this was something that within military and government circles on the side of the Allies had been debated for a long time. Should it be done? Should it not be done? That they were prepared to do it and that they did indeed wait. So what we're talking about here did occur late in the war. The first of these was summer of 1943. So if one had to ask the question, as far as the Allies were concerned, what was the ultimate justification here? It was that, yes, we recognize that this will result in great loss of civilian life. However, this war has been going on for a long time now. A lot of people have been killed. Who knows how much longer it will go? More people will die. So the justification is here, if this bring an end to the war and an end to the killing, that's an adequate and appropriate kind of reason to do this.
Well, David, interestingly enough, that point that you just put there was in fact not one of the major justifications used for the bombing, because by the time the decision was made to attack civilian populations, as I say, first in 1942, but the campaign really geared up and became genuinely effective in 1943, by that time, of course, people who were leading the Allied campaigns realized that the tide of war had turned. For one thing, the Nazis were bogged down on the Eastern Front and were having a very difficult time there. They were bleeding to death against the Russian forces. And Winston Churchill said on the 7th of December 1941, that's the day after Pearl Harbor, after the United States of America had entered the war, Winston Churchill said to his aides, "The war is won. We don't know when it's going to end, but we know that we are going to win it," because the war, of course, was about the numbers of ships, of tanks, of planes, of men, of factories. And the longer the war went on, the more certain it was that the Allies would win. And so if you go fast forward to 1943 and you see ratcheting up the bombing campaign there, it wasn't a question of looking for a weapon that would help in a dire emergency, because in a way the turning point had already come. Hmm. What the real answer to it is that Winston Churchill had said to Arthur Harrison, Charles Portal, who were the head of the RAF Bomber Command, he let them be more or less semi-autonomous and said, "Get on with it, and be as much of a distraction and a nuisance as you can be." But he never believed, as they did, he, Churchill, never believed that it would be a war-winning weapon. He just thought it would be a distraction. Yeah. And it had this sort of semi-autonomous warlord kind of atmosphere about it, which is really shocking in a way, because from the end of 1944 to the standing down of the bombing campaign in 1945 in April, more bombs were dropped on the cities of Germany than in the whole of the war beforehand. And by that time, of course, the Allied forces were already crossing the borders of Germany.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Anthony Grayling. He's professor of philosophy at Birkbeck College of the University of London. He's a fellow of the World Economic Forum, past chairman of the Human Rights Organization June 4th, contributes frequently to the Financial Times and The Economist, and is often heard on radio and seen on television. He is the author of a recently published book that explores this tactic used by the British and the Americans in World War II. The title is Among the Dead Cities, and it is published by Walker and Company. He's spending a little time here in the United States talking about the book, and this morning he's in San Francisco. We do have a caller and would welcome others into the conference. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's the caller in Champaign and line 1. Hello.
Yes, sir. It's fantastic to talk to you, and I think this is an extremely important topic. I'm a scholar of Japan myself, actually, and I'm fascinated by this horrific series of arguably, of course, terrible war crimes that were committed. And something that I find interesting is that Robert McNamara, the former Secretary of Defense in the United States, he was serving under Curtis LeMay in the American Air Force during the bombings, and LeMay was apparently in charge of these, at least in the Japanese case. Of course, I'm sure you're aware, I don't know about the British, but Americans, very few are even aware that something similar to napalm was used on human beings in World War II, and in the case of Japan, in 66 cities, so Tokyo plus 65 more. What's interesting is that McNamara says in a recent award-winning documentary called Fog of War that he said acted as war criminals. He said we literally targeted women and children, families, and so on. And so he does not at all not admit to what happened exactly. And I was actually quite surprised that he was so open about this. Of course, he suggested it was a necessary evil given the state of the war at the time. And I'd be in your comments on that in a moment. But one thing I wanted to note is there's a very interesting Japanese film animation called Grave of the Fireflies, which also draws attention to this quite incredible series of events. In the Japanese case, I know that they're suggesting that there may have been as many as, 900,000 deaths due to this. At any rate, probably four times the number of people who died in the atomic bombs. And so I wonder, what was the strategic reason for this other than cruelty? In the case of probably Germany as well, but in the Japanese case, I really wonder with Pearl Harbor and the strong sort of racist element in the backgrounds, whether that had something to do with the intentions involved. Thank you, and I'll listen offline.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Professor Grayling, please respond.
Oh, those are very, very interesting and very well-made points and a very interesting question there, because it's important to notice that in the European theater of war, the United States Army Air Force, the Mighty 8th, which was based in Britain, and the 15th, which was based in Italy, did not carry out area bombing attacks. They bombed by day, and they bombed precision targets, or tried to bomb as precisely as they could within the constraints of technology of the time. Of course, de facto, sometimes they did do area bombing when they were bombing through cloud and so on, but the aim of the American Army Air Force was not area bombing, but tactical precision bombing. And in fact, the effect of the American bombing in Europe was very, very significant, because they attacked transport, they attacked fuel supplies, coal mines, they attacked vital factories that were producing aircraft for the Germans. It had a very, very big impact on the war. I mean, how big an impact you can tell from the fact that when the Russian troops were crossing the Vistula River, heading west towards Berlin, they were met by 12,000 Panzer tanks on the Baranov bridgehead, a very, very formidable force. But those tanks couldn't move because they had no fuel, and they were overrun in a matter of hours. And so what the American Army Air Force did in the European theater was very, very vital. And it took a huge amount of courage, because they flew by day, and it was only when they finally got Mustang fighter cover, which could travel with them all the way from England to Berlin and back, that they were able to be as completely effective as they wanted to. But in the Pacific theater, the tactic was 180 degrees different. As soon as the Mariana Islands were captured and the bomber force could attack the main islands of Japan from there, the man in charge, Curtis LeMay, a name to conjure with, told his bomb crews to strip out the guns from their B-29 superfortresses to lessen the weight so they could fill up with more incendiary bombs. And they went and they bombed and burned down, as your caller said, 66 cities in Japan. And the most terrible of those attacks was the firebombing attack on Tokyo, the 9th and 10th of March, 1945. And Curtis LeMay said, "We baked," and I'm quoting him here, "we baked, we boiled, burned more people in Tokyo on that night than were killed in the atom bomb attacks on either Hiroshima and Nagasaki." And Curtis LeMay himself said, "If we had lost the war, I would have been a war criminal." Now, that attack on Japan, that assault, was particularly vicious for exactly the reason that your caller suggested there. Whereas, many of the people who were involved in the bombing campaign in the United States Army Air Force in Europe had, for example, German names. I mean, the person in command of the bomber group, there was a man called Karl Spatz, 2E Spatz he was known as, of German descent. Not that they were sympathetic to the Nazi regime by any stretch of the imagination, but they understood what was happening in Europe and what the bombing meant for the old cities of Europe and all its culture. But in the case of Japan, there was, on record, there was a very, very great deal of anger against the Japanese. After all, as the United States forces fought their very, very bitter battles up through the islands of the Pacific, freeing POWs who'd been very badly treated by the Japanese, they'd heard about the Bataan Death March, and of course there was a great deal of anger about the perfidy of the Pearl Harbor attacks, that there was a very bitter, deep anger with a big racist edge to it in the attacks on Japan. Now, the most important point to make about all this is the following, that more than 4 months before the atom bombs were dropped on the 6th and 9th of August, 1945, the Japanese had begun to make overtures for a ceasefire and for surrender talks. And they made one condition, was which was that they could keep their... Now, back in Casablanca in 1942, Churchill and Roosevelt had agreed that the Axis powers must surrender without any conditions. And so this fact was used, and some critics of the Truman regime say that this was used as an excuse to keep the war going until those atom bombs were ready. Two atom bombs were used because they were of different kinds, and they wanted to see what the effects would be on major cities. And Henry Stimson, who's a great man in American history, tried to persuade Truman to drop just one of the bombs on an uninhabited island to show their power, and he was overruled. And when he was overruled, he took out his pen and he crossed out the name Kyoto from the list of possible targets that the atom bombs might be dropped on. But these critics say the war could have ended 4 months before the atom bombs were dropped. And so the excuse which is often used, that is, that it saved American lives because there was no invasion of the main islands of Japan, doesn't seem to hold water there.
Hmm. Well, just as I said at the beginning of the program, there are these two very large questions that you explore in the book. One was this tactic morally defensible? Setting that aside for a moment, let's go to the other, and not to put too fine a point on it, but was this, do you think that this tactic was strategically significant? Did it help end the war any sooner than it would have ended otherwise?
Well, and the answer to that, in fact, is no, that the area bombing tactic actually prolonged the war. Now, the reason why I say that is because in the European theater, the area bombing attacks on German cities had very little effect, if any at all, on industrial production. Right at the end of the war, Albert Speer was invited by the Allies to come and give a lecture. This is while he was in prison in Nuremberg, on German war production. And he astonished them by saying, industrial production increased every year of the war until the end of 1945, and it began to falter only because we were running out of fuel, and the fuel supplies were being interdicted by the American bombing in Europe. Up until that point, the German economy was not even on war footing. They were still producing double beds and lampshades and pewter cups and all the rest of it. Not one German housewife ever had to go into a factory to make munitions and so on as they had in Britain. And this was because the German economy was very large at the beginning of the war, and because they conquered huge territories in Central and Eastern Europe early in the war, they had these great manpower resources and raw material resources. And so the German industrial machine was massive. And it kept on increasing the productive levels all the way through the war, and the area bombing had no effect on that at all. It did have an effect, however, in keeping German troops and anti-aircraft guns and aircraft back in Germany to defend the homeland against the bombing attack. But of course, exactly that effect would have been achieved by bombing tactical targets, factories and transport links and oil refineries. So that same effect would have been achieved even if they hadn't been bombing the cities by night. And so the effect of the area bombing campaign has been calibrated by one economist who contacted me. In fact, after my book was published, he sent me an email message from the University of St. Andrews to say that his work suggested that if the resources of the bombing fleets had been concentrated on those targets that were really vital to the war effort of the Germans, that is, aircraft factories, fuel, transport, if it had been concentrated there, the war in Europe could easily have been a year or 2 years less long. As it was, because the resources were diverted to attacking cities and trying to kill and terrorize the civilian population into surrender, the war lasted until 1945.
We are at our midpoint. Again, our guest this morning is Anthony Grayling. He's professor of philosophy at University of London. His recent book is Among the Dead Cities, The History and Moral Legacy of the World War II Bombing of Civilians in Germany and Japan. Walker & Company, the publisher. We have some other callers here to bring into the conversation. We'll go next to someone listening in Champaign, and this would be line one. Hello.
Hi. I want to start by saying I think all war is immoral. And I think making distinctions between more moral or less moral is really an immoral way to argue. Having said that, let me go to some of the points that you raised, and I want to just counter some of them, or at least raise some counter arguments and hear what you have to say. I can't touch everything because you could, but let's start with the atom bombs. Though you cite some evidence, material about the emperor and the unconditional surrender, at the same time, there's lots of evidence, especially recent evidence, which goes through personal documents of people in the cabinet, in the war cabinet of the emperor, his various attendants and like, which show very clearly that up until the last minute, there was strong forces within the Japanese government and the military government that continued to insist on resisting the Americans and even resisting the American invasion. And it's only at the very last that finally the emperor was able to get some influence, and that there was a willingness to surrender. So we could argue the points, and it's not really, this isn't the venue to do it, but I want to say that the evidence is far from clear of what you said, that there was no necessity, and certainly for those who are going to go to war in the Pacific and who would have invaded Japan, it was far from a certainty. Then I want to go to Europe for a little. If you say that there was, it's all so clear, at least now with hindsight, that the war would have ended 2 years earlier had they bombed different sites, do you really think that Churchill wanted to extend the war and not end it earlier?
No, Professor Grayling, you want
to comment? Thank you very much indeed. Let me take that first point first, about all war being immoral. You're dead right about that, and I agree with you. Human nature and the human condition being what it is, however, conflicts will always arise. And so the question also therefore arises, is it the case that once a war is started that absolutely anything goes? Because if you thought that, then you would also think that it would be okay to bayonet babies. Now, that's a very, very shocking thought. If you put that point to most people, they would say, well, certainly not. No. And then if they say no, your response has to be, okay, so there are limits even in war. And that raises the question, what are those limits going to be? How are we going to behave? Earlier on, I quoted what Bishop Bell said in 1943 in the House of Lords in the British Parliament. He said, we're fighting barbarians. Why are we being barbarians also? You look at the great scandal that broke out over My Lai in the Vietnam War, and that is a marker of how people are not prepared to accept certain kinds of behavior, even in the dire emergency of war. And that seems to me tremendously important. I mean, for hundreds and hundreds of years in our Western tradition, people have debated the question of restraint, even in time of conflict and difficulty, of trying to preserve a limit. And in the discussion about international law, the idea has come forward that a war can only be counted a just war if the means that are used are proportional to the end, which is victory. That if you go beyond that, if your treatment of people is cruel and excessive, then you have put at risk the very idea of the war itself being just. It's a bit like cutting off your head to cure a toothache. That's what disproportion means.
Can I just say one point about that?
Yeah, sure.
I think it would have been wonderful had the Allies bombed all the German railways. And I think it would have made a difference for all those people in the concentration camps and those people in the POW camps. And the fact that the railways are in the cities was just part of the process of being part of Nazi Germany, is that that's part of that population's responsibility.
Well, now you're absolutely right about the transport links. That would have been a very important contribution to the victory.
Well, that's
you're also right about the fact that if you were bombing, deliberately trying to bomb, intentionally, that is, trying to bomb a vital thing like a transport link, and that civilians get hurt in the process, well, this is known as the doctrine of double effect, which says, very regrettably, but inevitably, innocent bystanders are going to be hurt in a war. There's just no way to prevent it. And that's what we mean when we use the phrase collateral damage, although that phrase is too often used as a kind of excuse or a fig for things that needn't have happened. But, you know, we're talking here about the deliberate, night after night, month after month, year after year, massacre bombing of whole populations in cities. That's not a byproduct of trying to bomb railway links. That is a tactic which is very, very questionable.
Well, that's the argument that I've seen made concerning Dresden. I know there's arguments in both ways, but the arguments about Dresden have brought up the fact that Dresden was a vital center in terms of the transportation in Germany. But let's just leave that, because historians argue about that and there's lots of contradictory points.
Yeah. There is something to be said about the Dresden issue, which is that the British bombed by night and who took as their aiming point a stadium at the center of the city, and the Americans who bombed by day and who did bomb the transport links focused on a very large marshalling yard which was on the outskirts of the city. And there you see, an indication of the kind of difference that would make by what your intention is. But can I pick up your point about Japan?
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. The record does show that there were very strong elements in the Japanese cabinet who wanted to fight to the last man. They wanted to die for their emperor. They wanted everybody in the country, men, women, children, everybody to die and to keep fighting until the bitter end. That's perfectly true. But there were also very important voices in the war cabinet who realized that the war was over. They realized this in the autumn of 1944, if not before, and they saw that all that was going to happen was that they were going to drag themselves down into the pit if they kept fighting. And that is, their voices prevailed enough for overtures to be sent through the Russians. Remember that Russia and Japan were not at war with one another until Russia declared war on Japan on the 6th of August, 1945. You can see what a cheap shot that was. They just wanted to get in there at the very end and grab some Japanese territory, which they did, and they still hold to this day. But they weren't at war at that time, and the Japanese sent through the Russians these overtures to the Americans in the spring of 1945. And that was from the section of the government that was very keen to try to bring the war to an end earlier. And even if that weren't true, even if the Japanese cabinet was still united in their determination to resist, Henry Stimson's idea of dropping a bomb on an uninhabited island as a demonstration should have been a first resort, really, in trying to persuade the Japanese, if they were still that recalcitrant, to give up at that point. But that tactic wasn't chosen, and that's one of the reasons why Robert McNamara, for example, in The Fog of War, said their dropping of the bombs was a war crime.
But they showed the emperor, even after the first atomic bomb, still was resisting and various other forces in the war cabinet were still resisting the idea of surrendering, and were still calling on the Japanese people to be brave and take this poisonous, bitter pill, which is part of the Japanese tradition. I mean, if you look closely at the Japanese tradition, suffering is considered part of the a vital point that's acceptable in a certain way.
Well, as I say, I agree with you. There were certainly those voices, no question about it. And one reason why it took a couple of days after the first bomb was dropped for people to realize exactly the portent there was that, well, you can imagine the circumstances. If something like that happened in a major city in the United States of America, the initial shock and the not understanding what had happened and exactly what the nature of the weapon was, that would introduce a time delay, as in fact happened in Japan. But the essential point from our point of view is thinking about how to handle the situation in those closing months of the war, whether to go all the way to dropping the bomb. Now, the most critical voices against the Truman administration say that the war was kept going despite these overtures from the Japanese. It was kept going because they wanted to see what work those bombs would do. And they dropped two of them instead of one because they were different kinds of bombs with different effects. They wanted to assess those different effects. They also had other fish to fry, too, which was the Soviet Union. Everybody recognized the Soviet Union was the next big threat, and they wanted to frighten them. And so the suggestion has been made, and it's a very well-documented one, that the dropping of the atom bombs was unnecessary in the circumstances of the war, and that many more lives might have been saved just in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but even of military personnel, United States military personnel, if the initial overtures from Japan had been accepted earlier.
I must jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but we're into our last 15 minutes here, and I have several other callers I'd like to try to get in. Let's go next to someone locally here in Champaign-Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Comment on so-called civil defense, like cities relocated some people to the countryside, and some historians said there was talk on both sides of preparing by building really big shelters and factories underground, but for various reasons, this was not practiced.
Well, is there something you could say about that, Professor Grayling?
Yes, indeed. Well, as a matter of fact, in Germany, that was done. I mean, the Germans knew there was a war coming because they were going to start it, and as early as 1935-36, they began to build these enormous underground air raid shelters in the cities, and they put some of their most important facilities underground. They put, for example, their V-rocket facility underground. Many, many slave laborers working in that underground facility died there, were worked to death there. Some of the oil facilities were put underground as well. And a massive effort of preparation was made like that. Of course, all the countries that recognized that they were going to be embroiled in this war made other kinds of preparations too. They moved artworks, for example, caves and underground facilities to try and protect them. They built bunkers for the government cabinet members to be protected from bombing. This happened in London. You can visit them now at the War Cabinet offices in Whitehall. And so quite a few preparations of that kind were made, but they weren't made in Japan. And that was one reason why when the bombing campaign against the Japanese cities started, there was a tremendous refugee exodus into the countryside. And one assessment says about 8 million people left the cities and went out into the countryside to try and avoid the bombing. But in Europe, anyway, those sorts of preparations were made to some extent, mostly in Germany.
Our next caller is in Milwaukee, and that's line four. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the author if his study of the history of bombing during warfare gives him any thoughts about the current plans by our President Bush to bomb Iran. I'm drawing from the article that was in the New Yorker about 2 weeks ago by Seymour Hersh, and then various follow-up reports, for instance, from NBC's Jim Mikliszewski and interviews with Hersh, that Bush plans, part of his plans for Iran are bombing of Iran in 400 sites for several weeks, possibly using a so-called tactical nuclear weapon. I wonder what thoughts you might have on that, the implications of it, what we in America might worry about in this regard.
Well, thank you for that question. And, of course, it's precisely because of the lessons that we should be drawing from what happened in the Second World War to apply now and in the future that I wrote the book, because I wanted to try to alert people to the fact that if campaigns are planned which either deliberately seek to harm civilian populations independently of the military, the direct military value of doing so, or where it's recognized that a campaign would have huge civilian casualties associated with it, even under the fig leaf of collateral damage, that this has got to be really thought about very, very carefully indeed, and a full understanding of the moral character of that action has got to be at the forefront of everybody's minds. Now, you see, in a situation like one where you had a Nazi regime, now that Nazi regime might very well have been first in the race to build a nuclear weapon. They'd already built missiles, V-rockets. They'd already launched a missile attack on the United Kingdom in 1944. In that kind of emergency of war, even then people might think, should we bomb the cities indiscriminately in order to try to slow down the production of these things or to stop them from doing it? Or should we try to find out exactly where the bottleneck is, which if we attacked it would disrupt their efforts to do that. I mean, these sorts of questions have become very pressing. The moral issue associated with them should be right there at the forefront of attention. We talk about this sort of worst-case scenario of 400 sites, many of them underneath populated areas, so that attacking them, even with tactical nuclear weapons, would cause huge civilian destruction. One immediate question you would hope that the military planners and government planners would be asking themselves, if they thought that this was a necessity, genuine necessity for the safety of the world, would be, would there be a way of achieving the same end, which was much, much more proportional, which didn't involve so many civilian casualties, which could be done in a way which was, you know, given the ugliness and difficulty and danger of war and the fact that lots of people are going to be hurt anyway, isn't there a way of doing this which would absolutely minimize that harm so that we could be maximally ethical in our attempt to deal with the situation? What you hope for, in other words, is genuine restraint, genuine consideration that would somehow or other modify and direct that activity if it turns out to be necessary at all, in a way which was able to avoid the kind of catastrophe that happened in the Second World War in this respect.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller and go to another listener here, Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. On that last subject, there's the Union of Concerned Scientists have a flash movie on the web that depicts the optimum use of a tactical nuclear weapon in a buster attack on Esfahan, and it shows that the plume of radioactivity would probably stretch all the way into India and would cause death there. So that seems to be totally disproportionate. What I actually wanted to call about is you've sort of been emphasizing that it was the Royal Air Force and allies that were doing the most nefarious bombing, and the U.S. was doing the more tactical bombing. But certainly they were under joint command. I mean, it wasn't, maybe the U.S. was letting the British do the dirty work or something. But it also makes me think, you were talking about the Soviet Union and the fact that demonstration effect of the nuclear bomb in Japan. Is it too insidious to think that the war in Europe on the was being prosecuted in such a way that the Russian front would still be active? In other words, let the Germans and the Russians kill each other for a while and we'll collapse it later or something. That's not well expressed, but I think...
No, I take your point there. I think that was well expressed. Yes, that suggestion has been made. Of course, it's very, very hard to second-guess all the off-the-record discussions and thoughts that people had, but the evidence seems to suggest that people on the Western Allied side, anyway, were certainly not overly concerned about the fact that Nazism and Stalinism were bleeding well to death on the Eastern Front, and there certainly might have been a thought to that effect, because after all, these people weren't fools. They could see that it would be in the interests of the Western Allies for that to be the case. That's certainly so. On your first point, it was in the European theater only, of course, that the United States Army Air Force engaged in specific tactical bombing, and not, as we've already said, in the Japanese theater. Now, what happened in the European theater was this, that at the Casablanca conference, Roosevelt and Churchill came up with a decision about what was called the Combined Bomber Offensive. And the Combined Bomber Offensive had it that the British would bomb by night, and they would bomb the cities. The Americans would bomb by day, and they would bomb strategic targets. And the reason why that was done was because, firstly, of course, the Allies had to show a united front, and they had to show that they were working in tandem together. But actually, for the months and years before that decision was made, or that agreement was made, the United States Army Air Force legal experts had been saying that attacks on civilian populations were illegal in international law. They weren't happy about it, and they didn't want to do it in the European theater. And so this idea of dividing the day and the night in the way that was done in the Casablanca conference came up, and that was a good solution to the problem. And the actual direction of the bombing efforts was left very much to the two different leaderships. So Sir Arthur Harris, at the head of the Bomber Command in the RAF, had complete control over the night bombing campaign, and Ari Eaker and Karl Spatz were in complete control of the European bombing, of the daylight bombing campaign in Europe. And they did, of course, discuss with one another and coordinate targets. On a number of occasions, the British bombed the city by night, and then the Americans came in and they bombed docks and railway links and so on by day. That happened in Hamburg, happened in Dresden, happened in the great Battle of Berlin, as it was called, that started in the autumn of 43, went through to the spring of 44, the bombing of Berlin. So there certainly was co-arrangements, and they discussed with one another, because after all, the headquarters of the RAF Command and the United States Army Air Force 8th Bomber Fleet in England were just a couple of miles apart in near High Wycombe, outside London.
Did you examine any similar legal analysis in the RAF and in Whitehall?
Yes, indeed, I did. And I mean, here, in a way, it's a shocking thing. Twice in the House of Commons, Neville Chamberlain, while he was Prime Minister, and he was Prime Minister up until the Germans attacked in the West in May 1940, he twice said in the House of Commons, His Majesty's government will never attack civilian populations by bombing because it is against international law to do so. And he was citing various instruments, including an agreement that had been made as far back as 1899, which outlawed throwing grenades from hot air balloons. And that was even before there were aeroplanes. And, of course, there have been certain attempts, for example, in the early 1920s, to outlaw bombing, although an agreement wasn't signed. But some experts thought that the fact that the agreement had been reached anyway, even though there wasn't an actual treaty at the end of it, was a factor in customary international law. So the British government itself thought, along with the American legal experts before the war, that it was against international law to do this. So when it changed in 1942, well, the answer to this has to be sought, really, in the very earliest discussion of these matters, 2,500 years ago, in the work of Thucydides, writing about the Peloponnesian War. He said, "War coarsens us morally, and we do things in war that we would never have dreamt of doing in peace." And he cited as an example the fact that early in the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians had a debate about whether it was right or wrong to massacre the civilians in a city that had betrayed them, the city of Mytilene, and they decided against it. And only 12 years later, they didn't even discuss the massacre of the civilians in the city of Milos. They just went ahead and did it. And this must be part of the story, I suppose.
We're very short on time. I have one more caller I want to try to get in here quickly. Line one, Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Could you enlarge upon this question of whether the bomb was necessary? Eisenhower said he didn't think it was, we didn't need to drop that thing on people. But then, as you referred to, the hardliners in Japan said it resisted every step, although they may not have realized the total devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki because of the communication breakdown. I'll listen. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that. I mean, Eisenhower is a great voice on this issue, and there were many other voices, too, including people who were actually present at the dropping of the bomb, who had very serious doubts about the morality and the point of doing so. As we've already seen, of course, the Japanese were divided among themselves about whether to continue the war. But in a way, what the Japanese were thinking and doing was sort of irrelevant to whether or not those bombs should have been dropped actually on civilian populations, rather than some alternative being tried first, like a demonstration of one of the bombs on an uninhabited terrain. And so it's our own consciences, and this is the point of this book, is to examine our own consciences. Here we were fighting a just war against very wicked enemies. We had to win that war. The worst crime would have been to lose that war. But even so, let's look at our own consciences and ask, did everything we do in that war come up smelling of roses, or are there some question marks we should raise there? Because if there are, let's learn those lessons now, today, in this time of emergency, thinking about Iraq and Iran, and about the future.
And I suppose that is really the ultimate question here. As I said at the beginning of the program, you raised two large questions in the book. One, was this bombing campaign, was it strategically effective? And the other question is, was it morally defensible? And I think people who have been listening here, if they've been paying attention, would realize that your answer to both of those questions would be no. Then the larger question is, at this point now, these many years later, more than 50 years later, what do we do about it if our judgment is that it was not morally defensible?
Yes, exactly. And that indeed is the whole point of having done this, because I think it would be futile now to retrospectively try to indict people for war crimes, people who are dead and so on. We certainly shouldn't, I think, point any fingers at those very, very brave young men who flew into the skies over Germany and Japan, 55,000 British airmen died in the skies over Germany. 45,000 United States Army Air Force personnel died in action. These are tremendous sacrifices and took a huge amount of courage. I'm not in the business of pointing fingers at them and saying they personally carry any kind of responsibility. The leaderships of the British and United States Air Forces, perhaps we could look at them and we could look at the politicians who let them do what they did. But the real value of this now to us must be to say today, we've got this experience in the past, we've thought about it, we've come to a conclusion. How does that modify our behavior today? There are going to be wars in future, there are wars now. We have to fight them, we've got to win them, yes. But can we do it in ways that limit, that constrain somehow the possibility of terrible barbarisms that we might commit if we weren't careful and responsible?
Well, there we will finish. If you're interested, those of you who are listening are interested in reading further, look for the book that we have been talking about. The title is Among the Dead Cities, The History and Moral Legacy of the World War II Bombing of Civilians in Germany and Japan. It's published by Walker & Company by our guest, Anthony Grayling. He's professor of philosophy at Birkbeck College at University of London. He's now spending some time in the United States to talk about the book. He's in San Francisco today. Professor Grayling, thank you very much.
David, thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to wyll.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Carl Spine Institute, treating the region's most difficult neck and back problems. Information at 217-383-655.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where the bull is in charge today, snorting and huffing its way to new contract highs in the Chicago Board of Trade wheat pit. The December's new contract high now at 9.45 after gapping on the open. Meanwhile, over in the soybean pits, we're seeing that prices have broken above their midterm uptrend line, a line drawn through the February and July highs, busting above it today. The current price on the tick in the January beans at 931 and a half, having traders believing that maybe beans can go above 1031 and a half, excuse me, having traders believing that beans could go above 1050 and maybe even approach $11 before all is said and done. Let's go ahead and look.